calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends. Sorry about the delay there. The wonders of technology. We're trying to get connected on the satellite and just general madness around here. Of course, it has to be a Monday. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. And on this beautiful, beautiful gray Monday with 8 inches of snow coming to the People's Republic here of Vermont and much activity all over the nation. Thank you. Thank you kindly. Strange things in the news, this BTK killer thing. This I found fascinating because first of all, the police chief is now on TV saying, there's too many details being leaked out and it's blah, blah, blah. But it appears that if this guy actually is Dennis Rader, I knew somebody so much like him once. That it's absolutely spooky. And it just makes you wonder if there's there but for the grace of God go I moment. This guy was such a control freak. I mean, he got a job with the city controlling other people's lives. He once measured grass in a front yard with a tape measure to see if it was too long, a neighbor said. We had a landlord once when we were doing business in another city. I'm going to keep this very vague because I don't want to identify this guy. And it was absolutely incredible. When our employees would be working late at night, he would break into our offices and try to, without being noticed, turn down the temperature and turn off what he considered to be unnecessary lights. Our utilities were included in the rent for the business. And one time he just stood and stared at one of my employees for like 15 minutes, trying to intimidate the guy so that he would shut down things and leave because we were using electricity after 5 p.m. One of our employees was feeding the birds in the parking lot. And so he went out and he scattered rice in the parking lot and he sent us a letter saying that he was killing the birds because we were feeding them and that would attract more birds. And he didn't like birds in his parking lot. And it got weirder and weirder. He followed my daughter home from work one day. He was stalking our employee. I mean, it was really weird. And, one of these just like super control freaks. And we finally took him to court to get out of the lease because it was too much. It was like, should anybody have to put up with this? And we showed up in the courtroom, and a friend of ours, actually, who's an attorney, volunteered. He was so one night we were just sitting around having a beer, and I was telling him this story, and he just went nuts. He said, "You're kidding!" And he's killing the birds. That was the thing that pushed him over the edge. And so, just as a friend, he said, "Well, let me just do something with this." And this guy was actually the kind of law that he practiced was suing doctors. That's what he did for a living. But he said, I'll get you out of your lease. We show up in the and this guy, this lawyer friend of ours, Bob is his name, was just absolutely brilliant, brilliant trial lawyer. He had gotten at that point in time, and this was 10 to 15 years ago, he'd gotten one of the largest medical malpractice settlements in the history of the state. And he did it because he was a brilliant lawyer. Now, he was a very ADD kind of guy. He couldn't keep anything organized, but fortunately he had figured out that and has still to this day a great paralegal who works with him. So anyhow, we showed up in court And you know, he's our landlord is there with his lawyer, and clearly all his landlord knows about is that there's this lease contract that we're trying to break, right? And in the preliminary hearing, you get all these, you know, like a dozen or a hundred or whatever it is, cases lined up, and you get up and you give, you know, say a few words, and the judge decides, you know, whether there's going to be a trial or not. You know, they're basically setting the calendar. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the lawyer speak on this. And she turns to us and she says, okay, you've got this case. How much time shall we schedule? You know, an hour, 2 hours, what is it? And Bob jumps up and he says, Your Honor, we want a jury trial. This man is killing small animals, and we're concerned he may kill the employees. And his lawyer looks at him and goes, what? And he says, and Bob says, and furthermore, he's already stalking the employees, particularly the female employees. And his lawyer is now like shaking his head, and our landlord is starting to turn red, and as in angry. And the judge says, you have evidence that you have some sort of documentation, and Bob walks up and hands her affidavits, signed and sworn affidavits from each one of our employees about all these. I mean, we had dozens and dozens of these incidents. And in fact, we even got a sworn affidavit from a previous client of this landlord that this landlord had broken into his offices and gone through his personal files. And this guy was a psychologist. And he was not happy about that. And so Bob goes up and gives those to the judge, and the judge goes, okay, we'll have a trial on this. And that was the end of that. I mean, right then and there, he said, okay, I'll let you out of the contract. And it never went to trial. And I have often wondered about that guy. He had a wife and he had a son. And as I recall, he had at least one child. And they walked around like, you know, when they were there, they would walk around like, you know, with the head down and the shoulders hunched over like a beat dog. And so anyhow, not that I'm going to call that city and say, you know, maybe I know a serial killer. But it's one of the tragedies. It's like this combination of obsessive compulsive behavior, which this guy apparently had, and our landlord certainly had, in my opinion, with probably some incredible feeling of powerlessness in childhood. Not to psychoanalyze this too much, but and it just produces these tragic outcomes. These tragic outcomes of people who are, you know, able to do things like our landlord did, or like this, you know, I mean, which is small stuff, you know, killing birds in the parking lot and stalking the employees. That's small stuff compared to murdering people, the BTK killer. But I see it as part of a continuum. And really what it speaks to, I think, is our need as a society to be paying more and more careful attention to how we're raising our kids and how we're supporting our families to make sure that, you know, these kinds of very wounded individuals are minimized. You know, the number of kids who make it out of, the number of people who make it out of childhood with the serious kinds of wounds that produce these kinds of behavior is minimized constantly. So step by step, which I guess brings us to the topic, to this larger topic here, the Associated Press, an article by Sharon Cohen. The number of homeless in America has grown. This is the headline. She starts out, the first two paragraphs just tell a little bit, you know, it's setting the scene, right? The family sleeps in a single room, its walls bare and windowless, its cracked concrete floor crowded with plastic storage bins and three mattresses, one for dad, one for mom, one for daughter, one for three young sons. Fluorescent lights will flicker on at 6 a.m. to start their new day. This room in an old red brick factory-turned shelter in Chicago is home for the Torres family. They consider themselves lucky to be here. They have a warm place to stay. They have three meals a day, and they have each other. The family is among an estimated 500,000 to 700,000 people who on any given night in America lack a real home. Now, this is something that until Ronald Reagan became president, essentially we had done away with in the United States. We had largely done away with homelessness in the United States during the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 70s. It was a terrible problem during the last Gilded Age, the last age of the robber barons, and it reached a crescendo in the Great Depression. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, well, we're going to do something about this. We're going to fix this. And we saw a steady decline in the number of homeless. And then Reagan came along and said, well, no, we're going to go back to the economic policies of the Gilded Age. And we're going to start this all over again, which is what they did. But now you get the conservative spin on this. Homelessness, back to Sharon Cohen's article in the Associated Press, homelessness exploded as a politically potent issue during the Reagan era of the 1980s. Yeah, surprise, surprise. Not only did he cut all the funding to the psychiatric facilities, so you had the crazy homeless. Crazy meant affectionately, but, you know, the people who were mentally ill and had no place to go. But also, he declared war on organized labor and on the American middle class, and so we had just, you know, homelessness starting. Anyhow, she continues, the number of those without a permanent place to live has doubled in the last 20 years. Doubled! You want to know what conservative economics brings you? You want to know what voodoo economics brings you? What supply-side economics? You want to know what you can expect to see more of? Just look at what you've gotten during the last 20 years. During the 40 years before that, under liberal economics, under the New Deal, FDR's economics, under the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, cut poverty in half in America, the number of people living in poverty, in half. And now we have 500,000 to 700,000 people homeless in the United States. And most of them are families. But some experts say, here's your conservative spin coming. But some experts say more people now fall into that category only because billions of dollars have been spent to build shelters. Oh, I get it now. The cause of homelessness is homeless shelters. That makes sense. We just need to do away with those nasty homeless shelters. And then we won't have to worry about homeless people. Because they won't be in homeless shelters, so they'll be, what, under bridges, out in the cold, dying? The Wall Street Journal takes a whack at this with a front page story today. In the headline, in Bush's ownership society, citizens would take more risk. And then the subheads, see, this is the rich talking to the rich. It's beyond Social Security moves, his vision encompasses health care and housing. And then the second subhead, this is right at the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, shrinking the safety net. President Bush's campaign to revamp Social Security is just the boldest stroke in a much broader effort to rewrite the government's social contract with citizens that was born of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What a friend we have in W.
Oh, yes.
Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he's so resolute.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Oh, the Supreme Court just had to go along.
So many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yes, welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. I believe that clip was Paul Weyrich, the conservative strategist. I may be wrong, but I think not. Pretty sure we've played it here on this program before. President Bush's campaign to revamp Social Security is just the boldest stroke in a much broader effort As I shared with you before, this article by Jackie Calmes, front page of today's Wall Street Journal. That effort, Jackie notes, to rewrite the government's social contract with citizens that was born of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and expanded by Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. They go on to say, in what Mr. Bush calls an ownership society, Americans would assume more of the responsibilities, dash, and risks, dash, now shouldered by government. In exchange, the theory goes, they would get the real and intangible benefits of owning their own homes, controlling their retirement savings, and using tax credits or vouchers to shop for education, job training, and health insurance. The emphasis would be on the individual, supplanting a 70-year-old approach in which citizens pool resources for the common good and government doles out benefits. This is the Wall Street Journal. I mean, just saying right up front, hey, this is what it's about. This is an article of faith, by the way. This is not the result of any kind of research or any kind of science. Bush believes this. He doesn't know it. In fact, if you look at all the empirical evidence, you see that the economic policies that Bush is proposing have been rejected by most of the nations of Europe, and they're doing very well, thank you very much. Yeah, so they're, you know, a couple of them, particularly with the consolidation of Europe and the ability of cheap labor now to compete with the other countries, they're having some problems in those regards. But with regard to the American dream, the middle-class dream, it's still alive and well in Europe. It's dying here in the United States. In fact, they point out in the Wall Street Journal article that this is a belief structure of Bush's, just, you know, like his born-again sobriety. Well, here, let me quote Jackie Calmes. The president's policies, as his advisors say, reflect his deeply held belief that ownership has the power to transform people, just as he feels transformed by a midlife decision to quit drinking and embrace religion. It was the front page of the Wall Street Journal. They talk about, and they point out, this, you got to give them credit. When the wealthy in America, the controlling class in America are talking to themselves, they're just right up front about it. The centerpiece of his fix, they're talking about the privatization accounts, won't help Social Security's long-term solvency, the president acknowledges, they say. And, in his inaugural address, they quote Mr. Bush, we will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance. How are you going to do that? And interest deductions on homes? I mean, you know, Franklin Roosevelt already did that, Mr. Bush. We went from virtually nobody owning homes to something 60-70% of Americans owning homes. Actually, I don't have the percentage right here in front of me. I shouldn't just toss out numbers like that. To a significant percentage, I know it recently went up. I'll have that for you. In any case, as a result of this middle class welfare program, which is called tax deductions on mortgage interest, what more you get? You know, in healthcare, Mr. Bush is pushing health savings accounts. You got to hear what George Bush has to say about this. And what some of the serious conservative economists have to say on it. 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad...
Tyler, we've been over this 3 times.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Tom Hartman here with you. Critics say Mr. Bush's vision is blind to economic risks facing Americans, especially lower income workers. Notes Jackie Calmes in the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Article in Bush's Ownership Society, citizens would take more risk. They quote a Brookings Institution economist, William Gale, saying, quote, the dismantling the safety net society is what you should call this thing, not the ownership society. It's the dismantling the safety net society. Some applaud his rhetoric, notes the journal, but say the president's policies heavy on tax breaks don't broaden ownership but favor the well-off. The poorest workers, exempt from income taxes, can't take advantage of tax breaks for savings. Indeed. It's just really quite remarkable. They talk about how his mindset came out of hanging out in small Texas towns and petroleum clubs, small town petroleum clubs, local business leaders. In fact, they talk about his losing bid for Congress in 1978 in Texas. As far back as the young oil man's losing bid for Congress in 78, Mr. Bush proposed carving private accounts from Social Security. After his defeat, Mr. Bush went back. Now, I'm quoting from the Wall Street Journal. This is not Michael Moore speaking. This is the Wall Street Journal. After his defeat, Mr. Bush went back to the oil business and then became part owner of the Texas Rangers baseball team. His own financial risks and business failures through the 1980s were cushioned by investors drawn from his family's circle, which includes, of course, Salim bin Laden, Osama's brother, who helped bail out George W. And they talk about how Newt Gingrich and Jack Kemp and all these guys were popularizing this. Oh, we're going to get rid of the welfare state and sort of opportunity society. And over in Great Britain, Margaret Thatcher's doing it. And she screwed up their social security system so bad they had to pass new laws to prevent the financial services industry from further wrecking people's retirements. It's a disaster right now. Nonetheless, their ideas, says the journal, shrinking government and cutting taxes so individuals would fend more for themselves were the basis of Mr. Bush's thinking, according to past and current advisors. Democrat, I thought this was an interesting note, an interesting point. Grover Norquist has come out and said the real agenda behind Social Security privatization is to create a permanent majority party among the Republicans. How? Make everybody a stockholder. Somehow Grover Norquist thinks that if you own stock, you must become a Republican. Well, first of all, that's a fantasy. And just ask Warren Buffett. Certainly the largest single stockholder in the United States, who was an outspoken opponent of George W. Bush in this last election. But anyhow, Norquist says, this quoting from the Wall Street Journal again, Democrats insist his goal is complete privatization, that being of Social Security, and fear a partisan motive as well. Conservative activist and White House ally Grover Norquist, for example, says more stock owners would be more Republicans, making the party, quote, a true and permanent national majority. He adds, obviously Social Security is the key to getting this done. Yeah. I got to tell you, Republicans, you take away people's Social Security, you screw up this system that has worked really well all these years, when all it needs is a little bit of fine-tuning. All it needs is just, you know, raise that cap on income so that the wealthy pay into it at the same rate that us peons do. You know, if Bill Gates was paying into the Social Security Trust Fund the same rate the rest of us, there'd be plenty of money. You mess with it beyond that, you're not going to have a permanent Republican majority. You're going to see the end of Republicans. I mean, have they not learned their lesson from the 30s? Apparently not. In 1948 was when we started offering a tax-free interest deduction for homeownership, making interest on your mortgage tax-deductible. The journal notes, for low-income renters, the situation is getting tighter. Spending for rental vouchers isn't increasing enough to cover rising housing costs or the number of families seeking help. And then they point out that George Bush's budget request for this fiscal year 2006 through 2010, again, quoting the Wall Street Journal, would leave the government able to fund vouchers for 370,000 fewer families than this year. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a frequent critic of the president's policies. At the same time, again, I'm still reading from the Wall Street Journal, at the same time, the federal government and local housing authorities are steadily cutting back on the stock of public housing. This, says Sheila Crowley, president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, is the most radical change in housing policy since the New Deal. Well, it's the reversal of the New Deal. See, it's just incredible to me that so few people, so few just, you know, average folk in America, don't get what's going on. I mean, there is a war of ideas here going on, a major war of ideas, and they are both old ideas, essentially. And that is, on the one hand, you've got the old idea of tyranny and aristocracy, the old idea of the ruling class, the old idea of plutocracy and kleptocracy, the old idea of the robber barons, the old idea of Scrooge and Marley and Bob Cratchit, right? The owning class and the working class, and there being a huge gulf between them, where the working class has no health care and doesn't know what they're going to do, and, you know, bloody, bloody, you know, A Christmas Carol, right? Charles Dickens' story. That's the world that George W. Bush wants to take us back to. And then there's the old idea of society as a social safety net. That's what society is all about, is we get together and we say, you know, there are certain minimums in our society that we're not willing to drop below. We really don't want to have beggars on our streets. We really don't want to have children growing up in a way that so psychologically damages and wounds them that they are a threat to society when they become adults and we have to incarcerate them. We really would just, you know, we really want to have a well-educated workforce. We want to have our kids learn. And we're willing to pay for that. And so we get together and we pay for things like public education. And we put into place programs that support the middle class. And we empower labor so that they can, you know, capital can organize, labor can organize. These were the ideas of Franklin Roosevelt and many before him. I mean, this is nothing new. Neither of these ideas are particularly new. But they have been in dynamic conflict ever since the founding of this country, when Alexander Hamilton and John Adams represented the conservative side and said, you know, essentially the same stuff that Bush is saying now, and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson represented what today would be called the liberal side. And Jefferson, for example, saying people should not even pay any tax whatsoever on the first of their income that meets what Jefferson called the necessaries of life. In other words, Jefferson, our first president, to propose progressive taxation. And the cons have flipped this back around and said, no. You pay income tax, even if you only make $5,000 a year, you pay income tax on all of it. If you make $15,000 a year, you pay income tax on all of it. You make $20,000 a year, you pay income tax on all of it. Up to $90,000 a year, you pay income tax on all of it. But if you make $1 million a year, or $1 billion a year, you only pay income tax on the first $90,000. That's the conservative way. As much as I dislike, you know, quoting him as a social commentator, as Rush Limbaugh has pointed out, and why didn't America hear this, and why haven't they figured it out?
So what? Get over it. Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
You see? It's the end of the middle class. That's the agenda of the cons. The end of the middle class in America. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, if you'd like to drop into our chat room. Is Tokyo still in there? Looks like he's dropped out. Tokyo was in for a while telling us about there was a TV program in Tokyo on TV over the weekend about George W. Bush. And he said it bore eerie resemblances to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 movie. That would have been an interesting one to see. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Armin in Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, you know, Bush, first off, I'd like to say he's failed at everything that he proposes ever the majority of the people to participate under. He personally has failed at everything. He's failed in business. He's used the government to bail him out of everything, and his dad's connections and his corporate alliances.
Well, the one business he had that didn't fail was the Texas Rangers, and that didn't fail because they were able to go into Dallas and say, was it Dallas or Houston, and say to a bunch of homeowners, you must give us your property. We are and the state taxpayers were going to build a stadium. And then of course, he sold his stock to, I believe he sold it to, didn't he sell it to one of the Clear Channel guys for millions? And that's what made him a millionaire.
Well, what's the guy in on that name, Rainwater?
No,
didn't
I think
he turn over the University of Texas, all the financial retirement,
yeah,
all that over
to
one of the guys that was in on doing the deal with him on the stadium.
Yeah. Far after the fact. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, there, in my opinion, there was definitely a payoff there. But anyway, back to Florida. His brother's down here. Okay.
Yep.
He's so great. You know, if you believe the voting machines down here.
Yeah.
And you know, they're great ownership. Less government society.
Mm-hmm.
Food stamp participation in Florida is up 56%. That doesn't sound like a less government ownership to me.
Well, it sounds like an economy in distress. And in fact, you know, it's really interesting. There was another article in today's Wall Street Journal. In fact, I have it right here. Data boost view of economy with business spending up. And the first paragraph, the government's revised estimates of economic growth during the final quarter of last year showed an encouraging pickup for business investment. Sounds great, right? But slower consumer spending growth. In other words, business is doing great. The billionaires for Bush are doing great. The average person, they can't quite afford to even buy stuff at Walmart anymore. What do you think, Armin?
I think it's all a sham. I
there
think it's
go.
All a con, C-O-N. And I want to say one other thing.
Yep.
One of my drugs, Lipitor, that I was getting from Canada,
mm-hmm.
They managed to cut that off. So now I got to try to find something else, I guess. Get this. Supposedly, you can still legally get it from Mexico. So why do you suppose that an oil man in the White House Mexican border is open. It's illegals are flooding into this country. Illegal drugs are coming in this country. You can still legally obtain prescription drugs if you know somebody in Mexico. Why do you suppose that is? Do you suppose that's because he owes his soul and allegiance to the oil companies and the military complex and the handful of monopolies that really run that puppet called Bush?
Well, you know, it's entirely possible, Armin, although I have to point out that Canada is also one of our major oil suppliers. So, you know, I don't think it's quite that simple, but certainly something like that. Lorna, speaking of Texas, Lorna from Texas is on the line. Hey, Lorna, what's on your mind today?
We're originally from Canada. We've been here 24 years, and we've helped to look after the poor a lot since we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what they intend to do. We have a man now that we help to look after that's disabled, actually from one of George Bush's oil rigs that when his companies went under.
Uh-huh.
And
you mean you personally?
Man is retarded. He gets Social Security of $800 a month, disability. There's another lady on SSI because she has mental problems. What are they going to do with all those people? Are they going to get rid of them like the Nazis did?
Well, that's a really good question, because the Social Security insurance system, is an insurance program. And roughly a third of the people who are getting Social Security benefits right now are not retired workers.
Exactly.
They are people like you're describing that you're helping care for.
And they can't deal with these people, and they don't see these people.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of the great dangers. A dear friend of mine, Michael, lives in Santa Fe, broke his neck some five or six years ago, and he's paralyzed from the neck down, and he's living on Social Security. He was a writer. He didn't have a pension. Writers kind of live on the edge, and he said, boy, we were talking on the phone a couple of weeks ago, and he said, boy, I sure hope that he doesn't mess with my Social Security, because he says we're cutting it right to the bone as it is. I mean, you know, he's.
Right.
Living in low-income housing. And
that issue really needs to be addressed in Congress.
It really does, yeah.
Okay,
Lorna, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a real quick point. When five of the top 10 richest people in America are all named Walton, are all worth over $18 billion apiece, and we are subsidizing their business by Walmart employees being eligible for $2.5 billion in public assistance last year alone, something is wrong with this picture.
Yeah, I agree. Now, let me toss this out. This is from an email I got from S. Miller. Steve Miller. He says, according to Forbes magazine, the 500 richest people increased their already mega-sized fortunes the year 2003 by a total of $1.9 trillion. He says the $1.9 trillion is the equivalent of $76 million times $25,000, typical annual salary for many professions in the USA today, such as teachers, writers, artists, service workers. He said, what would happen would it make our society healthier and our citizens happier if 76 million people received $25,000 a year, or if those 500 richest people simply increased their wealth? We're not talking about taking away, just the increase in wealth in 1 year. Am I starting to sound like a socialist? I don't know. Matt,
well, it's the destruction of the middle class, Tom. You're right on.
It really is. Matt, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it. Yes, thank you. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll get into this a little more in just a moment.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There is no doubt we're running out of our petroleum. 30 years it disappears, and that is worrisome. So we send the fleet, but drag our feet on renewable energy. Cause God forbid our friends in Texas lose their monopoly. Though solar power would not pollute our water, air, and soil, we'd rather send our troops to war than lose a single drop of oil. We got 4 more years.
And welcome back. Yes, 4 more years and 4 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's Jordan. You know what's next? After Social Security is gone, what's next is Medicare. Then they take apart Medicare. And here George Bush has already said he wants to have a health savings account. And I quote, from George W. Bush. Hopefully, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, front page story. Hopefully, when I get to be an old guy, my HSA, health savings account, will be bulging with money, Mr. Bush told an audience recently, and I will be comfortable in the security of retirement because my HSA will be a part of other options to provide good health care for me and my family. Yes, George, you who was born into a multi-million dollar dynasty, and oh my God, it's Jeff in Denver's on the line. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Two quick comments. One is, I don't know if you've said it before, but I think we can safely call the Bush plan the raw deal.
Yeah, and by the way, I just want to add that I wasn't suggesting, and in reading this fellow's letter, that $76 million times $25,000, that $1.9 trillion that the Fortune 500 increased their wealth, should be just taken from them and given to us all. My point is that if organized labor in the United States was where it was 30 years ago, that you wouldn't have CEO salaries that are 500 times the average worker. They'd be back to 30 times like they were then, and you'd have average worker salaries that were enough for people to make a living.
Yep.
Anyhow, your second point.
Texas Ranger Stadium. Besides the point that Bush, this is the first time Bush ever made money, was off of the public back, it also was partially done unconstitutionally, apparently, because the powers of eminent domain were used in a manner to take private property. Because they took actually more land than they needed for the stadium. They also took land for retail establishments
right. That
they gave to them. And powers of eminent domain, there's actually will probably be a case before the Supreme Court soon.
Yes.
And that they're intended to be used for times the public good, not to give private property to other people.
Yeah, it's what the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution says, and it says it rather explicitly. But there have been over 10,000 cases in the last 6 years around the country where private property has been taken from private individuals and given other private individuals because they would generate more tax profit. So
yeah, Bush has only made his money off of the public's back, never on the private sector.
Yeah, well, it's the whole Bush family going, well, don't get me started. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay,
I appreciate the call. It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy and something that we must wake people up to. And the solution, of course, is political. Get political. Get active. Get involved. It's the radio home of democracy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle, here with Tom Hartman, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and in 29 states on cabled systems with Cable Radio Network. What is a basic income guarantee? This is a concept that has largely eliminated poverty, not just in countries like Brazil, but also in the state of Alaska. Why would it be considered a radical idea? Why would it not even be discussed in the public media? David Swanson is with the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org is their website. And David, the media coordinator. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back here this week. You're one of the great authorities and experts on organized labor and the situation of just labor in general in the United States. I found it interesting in today's Wall Street Journal. I was quoting a little earlier from an article that was talking about how the economy is doing, and they listed all these different indices, including the only one that actually had to do with people was consumer spending. But they had, you know, all these other things, all these other dimensions of corporate activity. Nowhere in there was mentioned wages. Nowhere.
Yeah. It's you can have a jobless recovery because, you know, jobs don't count. You can have a recovery in which wages don't go anywhere.
Right. Or you can have a recovery where you get a lot of new jobs at $5.15 an hour.
Yeah. That's right. With no benefits and with no rights in the workplace and no vacation time, it's, measuring how the economy is doing for average people as opposed to for Wall Street is not what the business pages are about.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we have lost any measure of how the average working person is doing or any discussion in the mainstream media about, number one, the fact that ever since Ronald Reagan's conservative economic policies began in the United States, up through and including to a large extent Bill Clinton's, many of his policies, which I would consider conservative economic policies as well. Not all of them. Clinton did a lot of good stuff, but he did some pretty screwy stuff, NAFTA and GATT and whatnot, and really didn't come out and fight for organized labor the way that Franklin Roosevelt did, for example, or Harry Truman tried to do when he tried to veto Taft-Hartley. And it's not even being discussed in the media. I mean, there's just like no discussion. I can't remember the last time on a major newscast I heard any discussion of working people. Can you?
I can't off the top of my head, and it's probably been a good long while. I mean, you see these scandal stories sometimes on CBS about illegal trafficking of women from Mexico, but there's sex or there's something dramatic in it that they want. It's not about the broad spectrum of workers. And we've got the richest country on the planet. We got 35 million Americans living in poverty, 13 million of them children, 500,000 people without even a home of any sort. And, and that's measuring poverty by a very restricted measure. We have tens and tens of millions of people struggling in this country.
So now you've written an article, Basic Income Guarantee versus the Corporate Media, pointing out that there is this program called a Basic Income Guarantee that, number one, is being actually used in the United States, and number two, is not being reported on at all. And if anybody goes out there and tries to talk about it, they just, you know, just doesn't get coverage. And first of all, what is a basic income guarantee?
Well, this is the idea that a government would ensure that every citizen of the country has a basic income to meet their basic needs, regardless of anything. So every American adult would get a check once a month for some very limited amount, $800 perhaps, regardless of whether they're working, regardless of whether they're wealthy. Everyone simply gets it. And there are some advantages in not having to means test and test whether people are married or have children or have a job, because you don't have to create the huge bureaucracy to do that.
Right.
And you reach everybody much more easily. You also don't create a stigma so that receiving the check is a negative thing.
So it'd be like Social Security, basically. Now, why, in as much as there's no means testing, why isn't, how to phrase this question? It seems to me that at least when they were putting together the New Deal and then the Great Society, that essentially we sort of already have this, in as much as you have unemployment, you have a minimum wage, you have Social Security. I mean, there are these systems designed to catch people who fall through the cracks, and then there's the minimum wage to guarantee that if people work, they actually get paid a decent wage. Why would not strengthening the existing systems, raising the minimum wage up to $10, $12 an hour, whatever's appropriate, or making, in different areas, it's going to be different amounts, presumably, and strengthening the social safety net for those people who are falling on hard times over the short period, or who have been, injured and can't work, that sort of thing. Why don't those just accomplish the same thing in a way that looks less like kind of a what the cons would call socialism or income redistribution?
Well, they very well might, and I would be delighted with either approach or a combination. But some of the New Deal programs are fit more a definition of socialism than a basic income guarantee does, in that they create large government structures that are careful about distributing from one person to another. But certainly the minimum wage is there, but it's lost over a third of its value. It needs to be put back where it was, and that would work very well with a basic income guarantee, because you want people to work, and there has to be some kind of significant compensation for working. Currently, there are many mothers in this country who find they have to spend more on childcare if they go get a minimum wage job than if they don't earn at the job.
Yeah,
so,
then they don't, yeah.
We need a social safety net.
So you're proposing this basic
wage standards.
Right. So you're proposing a basic income guarantee. Has it been tried before, and where? What were the results?
Well, it's been popular in this country for many years among various groups across the political spectrum. During the 60s and 70s, there were those on the left, including John Kenneth Galbraith, and those on the right, including Milton Friedman, promoting the idea at the same time. And it was actually endorsed by President Nixon, passed in the House. This was a limited version, but it was passed in the House and not in the Senate. But in 1976, the state of Alaska, under a Republican governor, created a type of basic income guarantee using a quarter of Alaska's oil revenues, which go into a trust fund, and investment revenues are distributed to every citizen every year in Alaska. And each citizen since 1982 has received almost $22,000. And when the reconstruction of Iraq was being formulated and discussed, the former governor of Alaska, a Republican Congress member from Alaska and a Democratic Congress member from Louisiana, as well as others, were promoting the idea of setting up a similar system in Iraq so that some of the oil revenue in Iraq would put money into the hands of every Iraqi.
Much as is done in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, and several of the Gulf states have very similar programs, do they not?
They do, and this is an idea that's popular in Europe, in South America, in Africa, and was just passed last year in Brazil. And the senator who passed it in Brazil will be at a conference next week in New York. But it's something that is in the global media, and that's been in the U.S. media very briefly in reference to Iraq, but
right,
never in reference to the United States.
Even though it's being done in Alaska, even though it's being done here in the United States. Now, this is something that would be funded how? Where does the money come from?
Well, there are various proposals for that, and there are other programs that, in terms of safety net programs, that there's still some remnants of, that would become redundant and could be eliminated. And needless to say, there are all kinds of corporate giveaways and welfare and tax breaks that need to be done away with. And the tax cuts that the current president has pushed through on the wealthiest sliver of Americans need to be repealed. The Green Party in this country favors a basic income guarantee paid for by taxes on pollution and the destruction of natural resources. So there are a variety of ideas for how to pay for it.
But then aren't you getting in bed with the devil? I mean, isn't that sort of like you have some states now that are funding their education through tobacco money? And they find themselves in the awkward position of really not being all that enthusiastic about anti-smoking programs because it's going to diminish the revenue that they're using for education.
That is an interesting concern. But, I think the point is that the money is available if we shifted our priorities from tax breaks for the wealthy, from potentially trillions of dollars in privatizing Social Security, and from an incredibly bloated military budget and an illegal war that's costing us, $1 billion every couple of days. If we choose to redirect our priorities, we have the money to invest in this kind of program, which is more efficient and fairer in a number of ways than some other programs that we spend money on.
Now, David Swanson. I'm sorry, David Swanson of the ILCA. David, why aren't we not hearing about this in the media?
Well, it doesn't have a major corporate backer. You don't hear about any programs that don't have a major corporate sponsor, and you don't hear about any programs.
You mean like the financial lobby likes the privatization of Social Security, so they're going to pay for that. The pharmaceutical industry liked the way the Medicare bill worked because it worked to their benefit, so they promoted that. There's no corporate interest. No corporation's going to get rich off this. And so they're not coming to bat for it. And so therefore, because our media is corporate owned, we're not hearing about it. Is that your point?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, 30 years ago, you could argue that this was a simpler and smaller substitution for New Deal programs. Now, with many of those New Deal programs having been shredded and the minimum wage having declined, the right sees this as the creation of a new safety net that they've spent years getting rid of.
Right.
So it does not have right-wing corporate support, and it's hard to move
in
the corporate
media.
Now,
next week, we got about 20 seconds left here. Next week, there's a conference and there's a website on this. Tell us about those quickly.
Yeah, there's a conference. This is the fourth Congress of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network, and the website is usbig.net.
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 Okay, great. And your website, of course, is ilcaonline.org, the International Labor Communications Association. David Swanson, the media director. David, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you, as always. David's article, Basic Income Guarantee versus the Corporate Media.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just before our stock did tank, we sold and took it to the bank. The workers still got screwed. It was our intention to build the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron. When Dick Cheney.
Aren't they great?
Now he's working for us, oh, Enron.
Ah, yes.
We're Enron.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Gary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada, sends a note. He says, greetings from Canada. Love your show. He says, one point. I've heard you say a few times that Canada has a proportional representation system of government. And there have been times when I've said it does, and there have been times when I've said that it doesn't, because it's one of these weird hybrids. But anyhow, and Gary points that out. Gary says, actually, we don't. And this is something that most Americans don't have any clue how government works in Canada. And Gary did a really nice job of boiling this down to one long paragraph that I would like to share with you, because it's just the kind of thing we should know. Right. And I, as I said, I think the average American is clueless about this. He says, we do have a multi-party parliamentary system, but we do not have proportional representation in the sense that many European countries do. In our parliamentary system, we have seats. Three or four or more parties may run for a particular seat. Okay, at the local level, you can run for a seat. The party with more votes wins the seat. The party with the most seats forms the government. Candidates that win seats from other parties sit in as opposition members. In our last election, for example, he says, the Green Party won 4.3% of the popular vote, but won no seats. Thus, they have no one sitting in Parliament. So here, this is the difference. It's in true proportional representation, everybody votes, everybody in the country votes, and if 4% of the vote is the Greens, then 4% of the seats in Parliament go to the Greens. So Canada has a system that is sort of halfway in between, and it's more because of the different provinces, I would guess. I'm not, you know, a scholar of Canadian history, but I would guess that this has to do with local control stuff. You know, we want to send our local people, and they're going to sit in that seat, and the local representatives. And I know, I think the UK is a little more in that direction, too. Anyhow, in our parliamentary system, he talks about this, and he says, if we had a European type of proportional representation, the Greens would have 4.3% of the seats in Parliament, or at least 4%. Another party, the New Democratic Party, the Social Democrats, won 15.7% of the nation's vote, but only 6.2% of the seats in Parliament. And then he says, there's a general campaign in Canada to change our electoral system to a proportional representation system. Time will tell. And he gives a website for it. It's peacefulcommunities.ca. And then there's a bunch of stuff after that that you can't copy down that fast, but there should be information off that. He says, take care and keep up the good work, Gary. Gary, thank you very much for that primer on Canadian democracy. I do appreciate it, and I suspect our listeners do as well. So you need to pay attention to the seats. And the point is that, you know, contrary to what Bush would have you think, there is no one right way to do democracy. There's a lot of different ways to do it. The Australians, for example, have done instant runoff voting, which I think is really the only option for the United States. We're not going to successfully amend our Constitution to produce proportional representation. It just ain't going to happen. It would be too big a change in the way we have government, and not enough people have any understanding whatsoever of what it would mean, even though it would mean greater democracy in the United States. But instant runoff voting, people can figure that one out. And in fact, it's on the ballot here in Vermont. There's a big movement for it. It's happening all over the country. So mostly in small communities, mostly at the behest of the Green Party. But it's a good thing. Work for it. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
And now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark. Kelly, how's it looking out there?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror. Yeah, we want to give up.
Oh, but you can't.
Sometimes you don't even want to try.
But you
sometimes
must.
Sometimes we cry.
Yes, and we pick ourselves up and carry on moving forward. It's really the only option. It is the only option. So this extraordinary press conference with George W. Bush and Vlad the Impaler Putin this last week. You know, I was so tempted last week to grab a clip of it And then everybody was talking about it. But there were a couple of points that just, you know, as sitting over the weekend, I just, you know how sometimes you get a raspberry seed stuck in a tooth, you know, and you just have to get it out with your tongue. It's like this it just kind of was nagging at me. And finally I said, well, okay, I got to play just a little clip here and just juxtapose a couple of news stories over them, because some things you just can't let pass without a comment. So let me just share with you this after George W. was called basically by a member of the Russian press, and they were pointing out to him. I mean, here you had Pooty Poo, right? What was the other nickname Georgie gave to him? Ostrich Legs. That's the other name he gives Putin. Putin, by the way, is some kind of double or triple black belt in karate. He can kill you with, you know, a small motion of his hand. I mean, he was the head of the KGB. He probably is responsible for the disfigurement by dioxin of Yushchenko in the Ukraine. And don't get me started. In any case, so Bush comes over there and he says, you got to be more democratic. And Putin goes, oh, yeah? Well, your daddy's Supreme Court elected you. Remember that? There was a little discussion in the press conference where Putin talks about the Electoral College. He says, well, we have this and this, and this is sort of like the Electoral College. Wink, wink. Well, what's that about? Well, what it's about is that George W. Bush didn't win the majority of the popular vote in 2000. You know, Al Gore had 500,000 votes more. No matter how you slice, I mean, this is, forget about Florida. And George's daddy's appointees to the Supreme Court made it possible for him to become president without them ever counting the entire vote in the state of Florida. Which, by the way, when they finally did count it, and it was reported on November 12th in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, I'm sorry, the New York Times and the Washington Post, it's probably in the Wall Street Journal as well. I have copies of the articles from the Washington Post and the New York Times. And they actually counted all the votes. They found that no matter how you sliced it or diced it, you know, forget about what the Florida Supreme Court was planning on or what Gore wanted or what Bush wanted. If you simply counted all the votes, whether you counted hanging chads, pregnant chads, whether you counted voter intent or not, if you simply counted all the votes, Al Gore won Florida. Took us a year to find it out, but we found it out. Now, that wouldn't have helped Al Gore a lot because he wasn't suing to have all the votes counted. He only wanted four counties counted, in which case he would have still lost, which was the point of the headline in the New York Times. And why they used the word ironic in there. But anyhow, Putin points this out. He throws this back at Bush. He says, you think you're so democratic? Come on, you weren't even elected by the people in 2000. Strutting around here telling me I'm democratic. And their press, I mean, I think Americans forget or don't realize the impact of a lot of the stories. Here we've got two reporters, one for Time Magazine, one for the New York Times, who are going to go to prison for a year and a half. Going to go to prison. Reporters going to prison for refusing to tell a source for a story that they didn't write. And so Putin says, well, you think you're the big guy, freedom of press, you're throwing reporters in jail. It's your Justice Department that's doing it. And you're doing it, obviously, because you don't want reporters to be talking to sources inside the White House. You want to intimidate them. You want to scare the hell out of them. And you're doing it. You're successful. They're all sucking up to you. They're all asking softball questions. Look at these people who are following you around this press corps. They're not asking any serious hard questions. And so George has to say, well, you know, our reporters, they get fired. And then Putin, no doubt in private, says, and what about this Dan Rather guy that you got fired by leaking a phony, you know, come on, don't lecture me about the free press. So Putin has his moment with Bush, and then Bush comes out, and they're in public now. And Bush starts out on his high horse again.
I live in a transparent country. I live in a country where decisions made by government are wide open.
Wide open. Allow me to read to you, friends, from the Washington Post, an article by Charles Lane, dated June 25, 2004, under the headline, High Court Backs Vice President. The Supreme Court ordered a federal appeals court yesterday to give Vice President Cheney another chance to shield the internal workings of the 2001 Energy Policy Task Force he headed, all but ensuring that none of its alleged contacts with industry lobbyists will be aired before the November elections. They go on to add, the White House will not have to release contested documents, will not have to, avoiding potentially embarrassing revelations to the extent to which companies such as, the now bankrupt Enron Corporation may have influenced its policies. Scotty McClellan, what did he say about it? It's an important principle. What's the principle? That government doesn't have to tell us what they're doing. Justice Anthony Scalia had come under fire for refusing to bow out, even though he went on a duck hunting vacation with Cheney while the case was pending before the court. Oh, you think we have an independent judiciary? Yes, Bush is going to lecture us about that as well. This is the same court, by the way, that ruled 9-0 in 1997, that exposing Bill Clinton's secrets about Paula Jones would not result in harm, but ruled that exposing Vice President Dick Cheney's secrets about his energy task force when he's supposed to be doing the people's business would result in harm. Yes, we have a very independent judiciary. A little more of Georgia.
And people are able to call people to me to account, which many out here do on a regular basis.
Yeah, right. When was the last time any reporter called you to account, George?
Our laws and the reasons why we have laws on the books are perfectly explained to people.
It's easy to explain to our people why we have laws on the books. I thought we made the laws!
Every decision we have made is within the Constitution of the United States. We have a Constitution that we uphold.
Isn't that exciting? I think you ought to read it, George.
And if there's a question as to whether or not a law meets that Constitution, we have an independent court system through which that law is reviewed. So I'm perfectly comfortable in telling you our country is one that safeguards human rights and human dignity, and we resolve our disputes in a peaceful way.
Yeah, just ask Iraq if you don't think we resolve our disputes in a peaceful way. Yes, and we have an independent judiciary. Yes, talk to Mr. Scalia. And yes, we have democracy. Yes, well, here, Helen DeWire and Mike Allen in the Washington Post, December 13th, 2004, describing filibusters as intolerable, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has hinted he may resort to an unusual parliamentary maneuver dubbed the nuclear option to thwart such filibusters. They go on to note several lawyers and former administration officials who have discussed the issue with West Wing aides say they see indications that Bush is heading toward nominating what one called a, quote, strong ideological conservative, end quote, rather than accommodating Democrats with a choice who would be confirmed with little controversy. They are getting ready to give us another Scalia, another Thomas. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, the website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, some of the finest and most intelligent discussions on the entire Internet, not to mention all kinds of cool resources. Logan from New York is on the line. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was just wanted to ask you about the documentary you were in about the 2001 election and whether or not that same director would be doing one about the 2004 election.
You know, the documentary you're talking about is Unprecedented, is the name of the movie, and it's one of a series of, I think, four, at least three, maybe four movies that Robert Greenwald has made that Earl Katz participated in the production of and a number of other really fine people. And there's a little interview with me at the end of it, and it's about the theft of the 2000 election, what happened in November of 2000, well, actually, the follow-on, you know. And they also did Outfoxed. They also did, you know, about, you know, blowing the whistle on the Fox network. They also did Unconstitutional, which is an amazing, amazing documentary.
About Iraq, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, about Iraq, and not just Iraq, also about the prison camps and things, and this whole, you know, just this whole thing. It's just they've done some remarkable work. So I don't know what their plans are for the future. They just sent a camera person out here and or a little camera crew out to Vermont. They're out in California.
I'd like to encourage any listeners to make a documentary about this last election. I think it needs making.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, Logan. And I suspect that somebody is. I mean, there's enough indie media around, and there's enough folks who are curious about what's going on. And certainly the folks in Ohio, particularly Bob Fitrakis and his friends who were associated with that lawsuit.
Lawsuit?
Pardon?
What lawsuit?
They're suing right now the Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio, for basically stealing an election. You know.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And so he countersued them. There's these four lawyers who sued him, and so he countersued them for frivolous lawsuit. And now they have the whole weight of the state of Ohio crushing down on top of them. The legal power of the state of Ohio. These lawyers, these activist lawyers. It's pretty grim. And they have been reporting it a lot in Bob Fitrakis's, I guess is how it's pronounced, his columns. And I think it's freepress.org is the website where you will find those things. So the word is getting out. It's just getting out slowly.
But, all right. Well, thanks for the information.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Logan. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Debtor Nation. Let's talk for a minute here about Social Security and where this thing is going. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Again, the Wall Street Journal today. Some progressive talk show hosts like to quote, you know, what's written in the liberal media, or the progressive media, mostly, which is exclusively pretty much websites these days. And I do from time to time, in fact, regularly. But what I find particularly fascinating is where you find the powerful class in America, the ruling class in America, talking to itself in its own publication. And this is the Wall Street Journal. This is a marvelous article by Mark Whitehouse in today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, Stocks May Dash Social Security Privatizers' Expectations. And basically what he says is that all of his numbers that these guys are throwing out saying that you're going to make out like a bandit with stocks are nonsense. It's nonsense. They start out by, you know, quoting all these bullish predictions, and then he says a number of prominent economists have two problems with Mr. Bush's pitch. First, they say it's too optimistic about the long-term prospect for stocks. Second, it ignores an irrefutable rule of finance. There is no free lunch. I mean, Bush is basically saying, hey, if you take money that in the Social Security Trust Fund right now is invested in Treasury bills and government bonds that return an average of around 3%, more or less, over the long haul, and put it in the stock market instead, which they're saying is going to return an average, according to their predictions, of around 6.5%, that you're going to make more money. And William Dudley, chief U.S. economist at Goldman Sachs in New York, says, if it was that easy, you wouldn't have a Social Security problem in the first place. Article by Mark Whitehouse goes on to note, problem is, the forecast raised some serious doubts, to say nothing of conflicts. For example, there's the assumption of a 6.5% annual return on stocks. By contrast, the actuary's prediction that the Social Security system will become unable to pay full benefits in 2042 assumes that the economy will grow at a rate of 1.9% between now and then, a tepid pace that would be unlikely to produce stock market returns of 6.5%. Do you get it? What they're saying, basically, is that these guys are rigging the numbers, that they're saying the Social Security system is going to run out of money. It's not actually going to run out of money. There's still going to be enormous trillions of dollars, a huge income into it. But it's not going to be able to pay all of its obligations. It's only going to be able to pay 70 or 80% of its obligations starting in 2042. And the reason why is because they're projecting 1.9% annual growth between now and then. 1.9%. They're running around right now saying that we've got 3%. If we had, and then They say, oh, but if we put the money in the stock market, it'll make 6.5%. But that requires about a 6% annual growth for the economy. So what they're saying basically is stock markets, the stock market will produce a great return, assuming 4, 5, 6% annual growth in GDP. Whereas the current Social Security system is going to be in great crisis, assuming a 1.9% growth of GDP. It's all funny numbers. And they expose it. They lay it right out in the Wall Street Journal today. David Rosenberg, chief U.S. economist of Merrill Lynch and Company, quote, that stretches the imagination. This whole idea that stock returns can be so high relative to gross domestic product growth. He says earnings tend to be in line with the economy, which means that a 1.9% GDP would produce 1.9% earnings growth. Thank you. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. So unless the government lowers the offset rate or real interest rates increase significantly, personal accounts strike many economists as a poor deal on a risk-adjusted basis. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. Would a rational investor, asked Mr. Dudley of Goldman Sachs, in a recent research note, would a rational investor borrow at a 3% real rate to invest in order to earn a 1.5 to 2% real rate? We doubt it. It's remarkable. Stocks may dash Social Security's privatizers' expectations. That's the headline. Article by Mark Whitehouse in today's Wall Street Journal. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Charles in Schenectady, New York, on the line. Hey, Charles, Rahm and I are debating how to spell Schenectady.
Very simple. S-C-H-E-N-E-C-T-A-D-Y. Probably something that George Bush can't spell, but definitely not former Vice President Dan Quayle.
Very good. Hey, Rama, you missed one E. That's it. Rama Schneider's in the studio with us today, helping out and engineering the program. Anyhow, what's on your mind, Charles?
I've missed listening to you for the past 2 weeks because I've had to move. But I wanted to know, have you been heard of and been discussing the crawlback provision that has been, disclosed in some way, shape, or form about this Social Security deform? I first heard about it through Sam Cedar, and I wanted to know, have you heard about it?
You're talking about the provision that if your income, if your return is less than 3%, you lose it, and you only get what's over a 3% return in the stock market?
What I understood as the crawlback provision, and I could be wrong, and, you know, it's very rare for
But we got to get to it quickly because we got about 10 seconds.
Okay. It's basically for the amount of money that you were to get, let's say you got 10%, you would still have to pay back the government what you would have made had it been in Treasury bonds.
Right. That's the
3%. And then be taxed on it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's the 3%. The 3% is the assumed return of Treasury bonds.
And this is just a scam, and no one really knows about it.
It's a scam because when you try to explain it, it's complicated.
It's complicated. The government, who's making the profit? It's not the investor.
No, it's Wall Street. It's Wall Street. Charles, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. We've run out of time here, but it's great to hear from you. You said it well, and that's what this article is about in today's Wall Street Journal. Stocks may dash Social Security privatizers' expectations. I think that's going to stop them, though. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty?
looking for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. You are in the democracy zone. No barbed wire, no passes necessary, no loyalty oath necessary. An open mind would be useful. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. If you would like to opine, call in and voice your thoughts. Our chat room, you can reach by going to tomhartman.com. We'll take you there. Economics, the theme for the day, the real definition, the ownership society that George W. is talking about, is that them who owns us. They own society. And them that don't own, they own nothing. Pretty straightforward. Susan Douglas wrote an article in These Times that was reprinted in Alternate. In which she talks about the wonders of the industry that George W. Bush wants to turn your Social Security trust fund over to. Wouldn't this just be a marvelous thing? She talks about the credit card, or the credit card, you know, industry, part of the financial services industry. She notes that, you know, some time ago, some years ago, when you got your credit card statement, you had a month to pay it. I mean, that was conventional wisdom, right? Now it's 2.5 weeks. If they don't receive the check within 2.5 weeks, which means you basically have about 4 or 5 business days from the time you got the bill in the mail to write the check and put it in the mail first class, or you're going to get nailed. In other words, you need to pay your bills the day they arrive, or you are going to be hit with these fees. And the fee, by the way, she notes, has gone in the last 2 years from $20 to $40. Why is that? Because there's no regulations about what the fees are. So the credit card companies just charge whatever they feel like. You dare miss a payment, all of a sudden you're wonderful 3.9% interest rate or 5% interest. You can get a credit card at only 7% interest. Suddenly you're paying 25%. Again, why? There's no law against it. We actually used to have in the United States usury laws. Usury is a word you don't hear much. I heard Joe Biden using this word on TV a couple days ago. Thought that's a word that we need to bring back into fashion. Usury is when you loan money at high rates, at rates so high that we, the people, that society agrees, it's a crime. It's taking advantage of poor people or people who don't understand finance or whatever. And of course, the famous usurers are the loan sharks who have for centuries preyed on poor communities. Shylock in the Barber of Seville? No, it was one of Shakespeare's. In any case, yeah, usury. The whole notion of usury is lending at ripoff rates. And we used to have a limit in the United States. Now, the limit was 10%, by the way. And during the hyperinflation of Richard Nixon's era, the result of trying to have a war and have social programs at the same time, Nixon had to lift that cap because interest rates are going up 10, 15, 20%. Well, I remember home mortgages were going 12, 13, 14%. It was just nuts. This was in the mid to late 70s. So he did away with the usury laws, and so we're left with what? The credit card companies can charge 25%. That's like a guarantee for perpetual poverty. And then they want to, change the bankruptcy laws. Now
yes, it's easier for you to get into debt to these huge multinational corporations, but if you want to get out of debt, if you want to walk away from it, no, sorry. That wouldn't be right. Well, there is a lot to be said for fiscal responsibility, and there is a lot to be said for holding people to their obligations. But isn't there something to be said also for companies advertising and promoting a certain type of behavior, and then when they get it, penalizing you for it? I mean, they're used to, when I was young,
back in the old days, back in the 70s, 60s,
if you wanted to get a second or third credit card, it would be very, fourth credit card? Forget it. They'd say, you've already got two credit cards. Why do you need any more? What are you, preparing to do some kind of flim-flam or something? Some kind of scam coming up? No more. No, you know, hey, you want your 22nd credit card? Fine, we'll give it to you. And now they not only can raise your interest rates, not only can they raise your interest rates if you're late paying them by, say, a day, but now they are looking at all of your late payments. And they do it on a daily basis, these companies. Why? Because if you're one, let's say you've got an American Express card and a MasterCard. Well, actually, I shouldn't name names. Let's say you have credit card A and credit card B and a mortgage and a car payment. And your credit's fine all the way across the board. And one of those, you miss a payment. Let's say you miss a payment on credit card A, even though you're up to date on credit card B. That then will cause the credit card B company to say, ah, we're going to jack up your interest rates. And we're going to increase the fees that you pay. Why? You call them up and say, what happened? Why am I paying more all of a sudden? Well, because you're a higher credit risk. Why am I a higher credit? Because you paid the other guys late. Well, how do you know that? Because we monitor it every day. It's reached a point now where if in the last year you have paid one credit card bill one day late, you are going to find that your mortgages are going to be more expensive. You're going to find other credit cards are going to be, I mean, it's like, whoa, what's going on? As Susan Douglas notes, is trolling for and sticking it to the most financially vulnerable. This, she says, just as in Bush's budget, those in the most financially precarious positions are the ones made to pay the most. This from information from a Frontline and New York Times investigation titled The Secret History of the Credit Card. Frontline noted the amount of revenue the companies generate from fees has doubled in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years. The amount, you know, the $50 fee, the $40 fee, the $30 fee, it's doubled. They can also change your interest rate anytime they want. They just have to give you 15 days notice. All the credit cards are controlled by basically 10 companies. Susan notes the Bush version of Social Security will be just like this. It will further impoverish the poor, the working classes, and women, and be filled with hidden scams that benefit the financial institutions at our expense. Just imagine the same financial interests that gouge you now have indecipherable rules in their microscopic agreements, enjoy no regulation, and can do whatever they want to screw the average American, will soon control our retirements. Priceless. And their answer to it all, let's make it harder for people to declare bankruptcy. We're walking and talking them into debt deeper and deeper. Well, the conservative economic policies are destroying, ravaging the middle class. Let's just make it harder for them to bail out. That makes sense. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Oh, you mentioned Shylock, and I just called. I didn't think I'd need to talk to you about this, but it's the best of my memory, that's from Merchant of Venice.
Merchant of Venice. Thank you very much. I knew it had something to do with Italy, and it was Shakespeare. And
yes.
And the Barber of Seville was not Shakespeare. It's a I don't think. It's a, what do you call it, opera, is it not? By,
yes.
Is it Puccini? No, I'm not a scholar of opera. I don't know. But anyway, okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So that was your factoid.
That was my factoid.
Okay, great.
And I had a question, though.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Go for it.
If people are going to pay, okay, if the Social Security thing goes through and the people will pay less into their normal retirement, normal Social Security funds, I'm not sure how to word this exactly, will then the matching funds from the industry be less also?
Presumably.
So this is a way to get them to pay less in that as well.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, nobody is talking about lowering the amount that's being paid into Social Security.
What I was meaning is they have a matching fund. I pay a certain portion and my employer pays a portion.
Right. You pay 12.4%, and each one of you pays 6.2%.
Okay, but if I pay some into this free market system.
Oh, yeah.
Then that will reduce my contribution, and therefore will that lower their contribution?
I don't think so. I think that what they're suggesting is that if you reduced your end of it by 1 or 2%, then your employer, you're not actually reducing it. You're just shifting it. You're shifting it out of
the... And so he'll still pay the matching fund.
And his match will also shift.
Yeah, okay.
But see, part of the problem with having a discussion about what George Bush's Social Security privatization scheme is all about...
Nobody knows.
Is complicated by the fact that he has said he's not going to tell us until this fall.
Yeah.
They're going to do the same thing that they did with Iraq, with the war in Iraq. They're going to do the same thing that they, you know, that they're going to do with the next Supreme Court judge. They're going to do the same thing that they did with the Patriot Act. They trot this stuff out at the very last minute and say, okay, take it or leave it.
And they're going to have the Republicans meet at midnight and pass it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's after they've done away with the filibuster. It's like, you know, welcome to the Union of Soviet Socialist. Well, it's not. Union of it's more like the Camera di Fascio, when Mussolini dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. I was just right there. Here you are. You've the corporations running the state.
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm pretty scared.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty angry.
Well, that too.
You know, it's like I'm not frightened by this because I know that this country, number one, has seen worse. Number two, I have a lot of confidence in the intelligence and insight of the American people. As strange as that may sound, I really do, because I think things do ultimately self-correct. And if you look at the 230-year history of this country, you see that that's the case. And number three, I am noticing just enormous numbers of people are waking up and saying, enough of this, enough of this. And now, you know, we got to get rid of these voting machines.
There's so much we have to do.
Some serious problems here. Well, we have to get active. Lynn, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Helping you win the water cooler wars, it's Tom Hartman. That's me, by the way. I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Going back to the Gilded Age, my friends. We're not going back to the days of Marley and Scrooge Incorporated and poor Tiny Tim and Bob Cratchit and whatnot. We're gonna move forward here. We are not going to allow George Bush to drag us kicking and screaming back into the 19th century. Ellen Ratner's on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. As you know, the president today had his meeting today with the governors at the White House, and Medicaid was certainly a big issue. And, of course, he wants to deal with it by block grants. Also, as I walked into the White House today, there was the first, and this is honestly the first time I've ever seen this, right outside the front gate of the White House was probably 60 people in wheelchairs saying, pass the resolution NGA, pass the resolution NGA. and this is the National Governors Association, what they want is a resolution that essentially, instead of paying all this money for people to have be in nursing homes, they want the same amount of money to be available so that people can get home care and live at home.
Right.
And a very reasonable kind of thing.
Yeah.
But of course, given all this that we're hearing now about trying to cut back on state Medicaid funds, this is not a good situation.
Yeah.
He said that he was going to work with the with Congress in terms of the funding for Medicaid. He said he wants Medicaid to work, but he was also saying, had Scott saying today, about the overall cost of Medicaid, $5 trillion over next 10 years, which is half a billion dollars a year. And, you know, I mean, let's say, let's face it, that is a lot of money, but it's only, what, 25% is actually paid for by the Fed or less?
Right.
The rest is really paid for by the states.
Yeah, and this is one of those areas where now we're discovering that these conservative Republicans, when they leave Congress and go to become governors of states, suddenly are changing their tune. I mean, it's really
right.
Quite remarkable.
They want the U.S. to the federal government to pony up more, of course.
Yeah, well, and in a whole bunch of areas. Yeah, I'm going to rant about that a little more after we get off the phone. But yes, and so is he getting blowback from? He's getting blowback from his own party, then, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, also, it's very interesting. Jim McCreary, as you know, is a big money guy, a Ways and Means Committee, et cetera, and is really somewhat responsible for what's going to happen with the president's Social Security agenda. Well, they are now making all kinds of ads available in his district, talking about sort of how he's spending money and also his connection to special interests. That's pretty interesting. They're really trying to hit him literally where he lives.
Interesting. Yeah. And
they're talking about really how he, how he's taking money from special interests, et cetera, his connection to them. And they're going full hog in his district, taking a page right out of the Republican playbook on that. Of course, also the president was all excited about Lebanon today and saying, you know, that the people of Lebanon have spoken. The president is apparently watching it with great interest, they're saying. And they're going, when pressed by the White House press corps, well, you know, are you considering this a domino as part of your Iraq policy? They wouldn't go that far.
You're talking about
where the press corps was going.
You're talking about the prime minister announcing that he's going to resign.
That's right.
Yeah. Or they're going to reform the government now? They're going to have to hold elections in Lebanon? Is that how it's going to happen?
Yeah. It looks like they're going to have elections of some sort.
Yeah. That's
and also, by the way, there's the class action issue, and the Supreme Court is going to use this issue of a person who rented an apartment in Virginia, saying that he got personal injury from toxic mold, to clarify whether this can be a suit in federal court or in state court under class action.
So to challenge their so-called tort reform.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
No sooner got inked and signed, and it's a challenge.
There you go. Good. Good. Because it's a crime. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen. Great to hear from you.
Talk to you mañana.
Okay. See you tomorrow. 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad.
Tyler, we've been over this 3 times.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Some folks have all learned to wave the flag, pull the red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, pull that point the cannon at you. It ain't me.
It ain't me.
I ain't no sinner, I'm God.
No, sorry. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the folks in our chat room. By the way, before I move along to this, something I've been wanting to mention for a couple of days here. There's just some fabulous research, and I keep meaning to just drop it into a little health segment, and it's, you know, one of those kind of
You never get around to it, this sort of thing. So I'll just mention it right now. So there's just been some absolutely fabulous research that has been published in the last couple of years, and particularly in the last few weeks. But not so much, actually, you know, I can't point to a particular piece in the last few weeks, but it's just, you know, continually coming out. I get these things, these science newsletters and whatnot, and Science News and New Scientist and AAAS's publication, Science, about the ability of fatty acids in the diet, dietary fatty acids, like fish oil or krill oil. Krill is the stuff that whales eat. You can buy krill oil capsules, these little kind of zooplankton, I guess it's called, or mixtures of vegetable oils to treat depression, insomnia, and bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness, what used to be called that, bipolar disorder, and the mania associated with it. And there's this growing number of very serious researchers. I'm talking about, you know, a friend of mine who's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard is the first person to turn me onto this. Told me about this was a couple of years ago. A body of very serious researchers who are coming to the conclusion that many of these conditions, and perhaps a lot of what gets diagnosed as attention deficit disorder even, is actually a nutritional deficiency, the result of the standard American diet, otherwise known as SAD. That the SAD diet is producing this wild nutritional deficiency as a result of a lack of healthy fats in our diet. Because the brain is like 80-85% fat. And it has this particular ratio of these particular types of fats, the omega-3s, 6, and 9s, and whatnot. And that particular ratio is virtually identically found in fish oils. And you can buy fish oil capsules. And you can replicate it with a proper mixture of things like borage oil and olive oil and evening oil of evening, primrose and flaxseed oil. So it's really quite remarkable, the research on this, and so I just want to toss that out. You're Dr. Dina Delmont. It's God bless him. He does great radio. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ed in California on the line. Hey Ed, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. It's just in case for the credit card thing.
Yeah.
When you do finally pay them off, and they've raised you to 25, 26, whatever they've got, and you pay them off.
Right.
What they do then is they inundate you with letter upon letter saying you get down to 0% interest on a new balance that you make.
Right. Or here, take this check and write it for $5,000.
I'd love to give you the checks that I got coming in the mail here.
Oh, it's incredible. But
then it's up to 25, 26% again.
That's right. Or if you get an ATM advance against your card, they call that a different category than a purchase. It's a cash advance. And a cash advance can't be paid off in 1 month. It's not deducted out of your payment. And so, boom, they're making 25% on the cash advance no matter what.
And they put most of it on the cheaper interest, so you pay that first.
Yeah.
It's a great way to do business.
Oh, it's quite mind-boggling.
And if you send them in a full payment, they still send you back a letter saying you owe us more money because we charged you interest from the time that we sent you the last bill of this, so you still owe money. See, we had that.
Yeah. Yeah, and about the only way to get out of this, Ed, out from underneath it, the only two
paid every month.
Have it set up for the credit card company to automatically pull the money from your checking account. And then you end up with no payments. I mean,
some of us don't have the extra money.
Yeah.
You know, we get talked into it.
That's the thing. You've got to pay them down to zero first before you can do that. And then you've got to be very, very careful.
And then make it tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really good. Don't get into it. Don't get into it.
Yeah. That's what we need to be teaching our kids in school right now, is there are predators out there. And these guys are frankly, in my opinion, more dangerous than the guy around the corner selling pot. There are serious predators out there.
Yell it at the top of your lungs to your kids.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get into it. One of my kids got just buried in this stuff and went through two years, I think, or so of, you know, credit counseling and paying off all that stuff. And it's a tough one. It's a real tough one for
because they don't send it like when we were kids. They send you a card for $500.
Yeah.
They send you a card for $7,000, $10,000.
Yeah, and I considered that really my failure for having not educated that one of my particular children about the realities of the world. And I thought that this was stuff that they were teaching in schools. It's not.
Oh, God,
and,
no.
And it's so anyhow, Ed, thanks for the call. I do
great
appreciate
day,
it. Good to hear from you, too. Linton from, is it Turnwater, Michigan?
Tumwater, Washington.
Tumwater, Washington.
Okay. Right, right next door to the Capitol, Olympia.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah.
Hey, Linton, what's up?
Two things. I heard you use the term usury this morning.
Yes.
And I had to chuckle. I just wanted to mention that a born-again Christian like Mr. Bush should remember the moneylenders in the temple. And
well, not only that. In
how they were treated.
For those in this administration who say that we should be looking to the Old Testament for our laws, for example, there's no prohibition in the New Testament against homosexuality, but there is right. in the Old Testament. So they go back to the Old Testament. They say, well, you know, if it says it in the Old Testament, that's good enough for me. Well, in the Old Testament, it says a lot of things that many people actually continue to do. One of my very closest friends is a member of a Hasidic community down in Baltimore, and they do not wear clothing that is made of two different fibers because that's prohibited. In the same part of, I believe it is, it's either Deuteronomy or Leviticus. It must be Leviticus, you know, where yeah, there's like over 600 laws, specific laws. They were in the same place where homosexuality is. And they won't eat shellfish and they, you know, they keep kosher and all this stuff. And, you know, so you go back there and you discover that there's a law against charging interest. It's yeah. against the law to charge interest. And in Islamic countries, they don't charge interest. They have a completely different banking system than we do because it's illegal to charge interest in Saudi Arabia, for example. And so the banks have to figure out a different way to make money. They make all their money on fees. They don't. Yeah. And so anyway, it's for those fundamentalists who really want to follow the Bible.
Exactly.
All of this stuff is as much of a sin, according to the Bible, what the credit card companies are doing, as two gay guys getting it done.
You know. I also wanted to tell you something, a story about credit cards. I was just on the phone with my insurance agent this morning who was looking into getting me an umbrella policy.
Mm-hmm.
And he called back and he said, well, you know, your credit's not good enough. And I said, that's not possible. I have excellent credit. I always pay my bills. And he said, let me look at this. He says, well, you have too many uncanceled credit cards.
Mm.
And so I guess, you know, my wife has accumulated JCPenney and Sears and all these credit cards
yeah.
because they give you a good deal.
That's right. They give you 20% off on your first purchase if you get their credit card or
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly. So I think she keeps those in her back pocket, you know, and
yeah.
doesn't ordinarily use them. And here it's sort of trapped me.
Yeah.
Now, and suddenly, despite having excellent credit, I have poor credit.
That's
because,
amazing.
Because they've, you know, fostered all these credit cards on us.
That's amazing. Well, Linton, thank you for sharing another horror story.
Nice talking us. To you, Tom.
Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Well, one of the folks in the chat room a little earlier. Interesting. Purple Raven's Edge. Deuteronomy is a reprint of Leviticus. You know, it's been a couple of years since I read through the whole thing. And when the 4 years in a row that I read the Bible cover to cover, I did it in one of those, you know, every night you read 20 minutes and you read part from the first half of the Old Testament that goes up to the end of Psalms. And then you read a few minutes from Psalms all the way through the prophets. And then you read the first four Gospels. And then you read the letters and Acts, the letters in Revelation. And so I never read the whole thing straight through from the beginning to the end. Instead, I read these four pieces. And so at the end of the year, you've read every single word in the Bible, but you've done it in a way that's where you don't have to slog through Leviticus in one night, you know. And so I never noticed that. That's interesting. I did know that they were both heavy on the law. So thank you for that comment. I learn the most amazing things here in this in our chat room. I really and truly do. It's just one of the great places to go. Anyhow, today in the New York, one of the folks in the chat, let me get back to this original question. One of the folks in the chat room asked the question in the context of these conversations that we're having, how do I invest, or maybe I should invest, in private debtor's prison? You know, is there a company that's running private debtors' prisons? Because obviously this is the direction that George Bush is taking us, is back to debtors' prisons, and this seems like a growth industry. Well, fact of the matter is, it is a growth industry. Not just the idea of debtors' prison. And yes, there are people who are successfully being thrown in jail over their debts. That's a whole other story. But the one that I want to get to right now is just the predictable outcome of privatization. When you take a job that we the people generally would have done by us for us, for example, being a doctor in a prison, dear friend of mine, George Thon, who I actually wrote about George in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, George has now passed on. But George was
an extraordinary, he used to be a Buddhist monk when he lived in Thailand. And he was working, he was a physician, he's an MD, and he was working in the prison in I believe it was Soledad. It's one of the Southern California prisons there. Or around San Francisco, south of San Francisco. And George was very committed to the prisoners. I mean, he saw this as like what he did as a way of giving something back to society. I mean, he wasn't particularly well paid for being a prison doctor. In fact, he had a private practice as well. George was a urologist. But he was this prison doctor as well. And now what's happened is that the prison doctors who are serving and working, you know, without huge incomes, but with a lot of dedication, are being replaced by people in it for the money. And there's an entire corporation here. This from Paul von Zilbauer wrote this marvelous piece in yesterday's New York Times. Private health care in jails can be a death sentence. And he tells the story of Brian Tetrault, who was 44 when he was led into a Dim County jail cell in upstate New York in 2001, charged with taking some skis and other items from his ex-wife's house. That's this guy's crime. Took some skis from his ex-wife's house. A former nuclear scientist who had struggled with Parkinson's disease, he began to die almost immediately, and state investigators would later discover why. The jail's medical director had cut off all but a few of the 32 pills he needed each day to quell his tremors. Over the next 10 days, Mr. Tetrault slid into a stupor, soaked in his own sweat and urine, but he never saw the jail doctor again, and the nurses dismissed him as a faker. After his heart finally stopped, investigators said, correction officers at the Schenectady jail doctored records to make it appear he had been released before he died. 2 months later, Victoria Williams Smith, the mother of a teenage boy, was booked into another upstate jail in Dutchess County, charged with smuggling drugs to her husband in prison. She, too, had only 10 days to live after she began complaining of chest pains. She phoned friends in desperation. The medical director would not prescribe anything more potent than Bengay or the arthritis medicine she had brought with her, investigators said. A nurse scorned her pleas to be hospitalized as a ploy to get drugs. When at last an ambulance was called, Miss Smith was on the floor of her cell, shaking from a heart attack that would kill her within the hour. She was 35. In these two harrowing deaths, notes Paul von Zilbauer, in the New York Times yesterday, state investigators concluded the culprit was a for-profit corporation, Prison Health Services, otherwise known as PHS, that had moved aggressively into New York State in the last decade, winning jail contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars with an enticing sales pitch. Take the messy and expensive job of providing medical care from overmatched government officials and give it to an experienced nationwide outfit that could recruit doctors, battle lawsuits, and keep costs down. And they have. They have kept costs down so effectively that one doctor who recently left their employment said that she did so in part, quoting again from the story, one AIDS specialist before she left this month called staffing skeletal and said she sometimes lacked even soap to wash her hands between treating patients. They were certainly maximizing profit, they were. Boy, oh boy. This company is doing business now in 22 states. This is mind-boggling. Yeah, you too can die in debtor's prison. Harriet in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Harriet, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, that was a pretty shocking article there.
Yeah.
There's another one, courtesy of the New York Times. Have you heard about the 9-year-old whiz kid that Bush is sending around ahead of his next multi-state travels promoting Social Security privatization?
No.
Oh, well, apparently there's a 9-year-old presidential trivia whiz kid, a Noah McCullough. This was the New York Times 2 days ago. And it says here, Noah will travel to a handful of states ahead of visits by the president and will go on radio programs, answer trivia questions, and say a few words about Social Security. And he says, what I want to tell people about Social Security is not to be afraid of the new plan. It may be a change, but it's a good change. And then it notes he plans to run for the White House in 2032, and he wants Social Security addressed before then. He says, it will be bankrupt when I'm president.
This is so pathetic, Harriet.
It is.
He's brainwashed a 9-year-old, and he's got this guy out on the stump?
Yep.
He's got this kid.
Well, considering everything with Armstrong and everybody else, you kind of wonder how much the parents are getting paid to ship their kid around the country and make a fool of themselves.
This is tragic.
It is.
This is just,
I mean, I think it's more tragic than humorous. I mean, it's, you know, the kid's been duped, the parents have been duped and or paid, and people are supposed to go for this?
Yeah, that's amazing. It's just amazing. Well, thank you, Harriet, for sharing that with us.
Anytime.
I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And keep up the faith. Keep the faith there in Seattle. Our day will come. We're right on the edge. I'm telling you, we are right on the edge. Americans are waking up to the insanity of this administration. Truth and common sense in broadcasting here on the True People's Radio. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife slowly. You know the song in my heart. In the turning of twilight, in the shadows of moonlight, you can show me a new place to start. I've torn my clothes and I've drained the cup.
And welcome back. I could listen to old Bob Dylan all day long, you know? But we won't. We'll move along. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ann in Sarasota, Florida on the line from West Coast to East. Hey, Alan, or Ann, rather, welcome.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to what a lot of your callers are saying about Medicaid and what they were saying earlier about the medical savings accounts. And basically what all this tells me is what the other industrialized nations have all learned a long time ago. Private health care doesn't work. That's why they went to national health care systems.
Right.
You got to take the profit out of it to make it work.
Yeah.
And we're seeing less and less people and it's costing that are getting health care, and it's costing more and more. And savings accounts will not help if you get like my brother. He had cancer. His bills ran over $600,000. There's no way you can save enough to prepare for that.
That's right. And the philosophy that we have had in this country for hundreds of years, and that has been part of, you know, most of European philosophy and Japanese and all around the world, is that those things that have to do with our survival are so precious that you don't, and so dangerous, ultimately, if they're in the wrong hands, that you don't put them into private hands. You keep them in the hands of we the people. So, for example, our police departments, we the people control the police departments. Our fire departments, we the people control the fire departments. These things have to do with our survival, keeping us safe from predators, keeping our homes from burning down. We don't want to be handing these over to private corporations. When we tried to do it in the past, we've had disastrous results, corruption, high prices, whatnot. And outside of the United States, every other country in the world agrees that health care is part of that. It's part of that commons. Whether the air is breathable, whether the water is drinkable, whether the food is edible, whether the drugs are safe. That's the commons, and health care should be part of that commons.
I agree. And I think if for as much as we're paying in taxes, and I'm not just talking income taxes, but when you put all the other taxes, the fees on all your cell phones and your phones and utilities and everything else and gas taxes, that you add it all up, we're not getting any bargain by not being private, by having private health care. And when you look at Canada and people say, oh, their taxes are so much higher, not really when you look what they're getting for their money. If they're going to take away Social Security and take away and they're cutting back on Medicare and they're leaving us without health care in this country and you can't buy into it, what do we have?
Well, what you have is the Gilded Age. You have the era of President McKinley, which is who Karl Rove has said he has modeled the Bush presidency on. The 1898. You're back to the era of the robber barons.
Well, then I guess we go back to the era of the riots and things, because that's what
that's
they did
right.
back then when they were
that's
held
right.
back. And
you were having labor riots. You were having the progressive and populist movement came out of that. The people said, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, what came out of that was actually a lot of very good progressive reforms came out of that. The direct election of the Senate in 1917, the right of women to vote in 1920, I mean, you know, two amendments to the Constitution.
just simply as a consequence of those abuses. And a lot of the for example, the citizen ballot initiatives in California. So some Democratic improvements might come out of it, but boy, the price is so high. Ann, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Do we really want to run this country into absolute bankruptcy, right into the ditch, in order to wake people? I don't think so. I think we can educate them. We can share with people the history of this country, and look at what other countries are doing and learn from that. We really can. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder.